As opposed to the Anthropocene, what is the Manthropocene?
The Manthropocene is a label that feminists have concocted in order to point the finger at masculinity as being the cause of a lot of environmental problems. So if you call it the Anthropocene, it suggests that the whole of humanity is equally implicated in the kinds of destruction that we've caused. If you call it the Manthropocene, you're pointing a finger.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with philosophy professor Christopher James Preston about his book, The Synthetic Age, Outdesigning Evolution, Resurrecting Species, and Reengineering Our World. What follows is a thoughtful conversation about what it means to imagine a future in which humans fundamentally reshape the natural world using nanotechnology, synthetic biology, de-extinction, and climate engineering. Stay tuned. One of the things this book taught me is that we are actually not in the Anthropocene. Can you clear up the idea of the next geological epoch and where we are now?
So there is a working group from the International Commission on Stratigraphy who are studying this time that we're in, and they're hoping to define whether or not we've entered a new geological epoch. And the consensus amongst the working group is, yes, we have. The Holocene is now behind us. The signatures that will appear in rocks many millennia from now indicate that we've moved on. My concern, though, is that the Anthropocene, as defined by this working group, is really this giant accident. All of these things that we've done unintentionally. We didn't plan to warm the climate. We didn't plan to reduce species numbers so greatly. We didn't plan to put toxins in Arctic ice. And so the idea of an Anthropocene, to me, is a little bit misguided. It really should be called the big accident or the scene of destruction or something like that. So in my work, I seek to sort of redefine it, give it a better name, and call it the Synthetic Age.
That's right. And the subtitle of your book is Outdesigning Evolution, Resurrecting Species, and Reengineering Our World. And one of the paragraphs towards the end of the book, you write, "The whole definition about this shifting epoch seems to have gotten off on the wrong foot. The fact that our species has accidentally left its signature in every remote bay, on every mountaintop, and across every continent is certainly a major cause for introspection. But it does not seem like the right opportunity to celebrate our untidiness by naming the next epoch in our honor." And instead, you call it the Plasticine, and actually your website is theplasticine.com. What are the markers of this?
So I went back and forth between calling it the Plasticine and calling it the Synthetic Age. As I just said, the Anthropocene seemed like the wrong name. Giant accident, big mistake. Why would you want to celebrate that? But there is this sense that from now on, we can take technologies and do something much more radical than anything we've done before. So, okay, before we had a global impact, but we didn't intentionally go in and rewire and re-engineer the Earth. But that's what we're looking at now. There's technologies available from the atom to the atmosphere that could literally rewire and re-engineer the planet. To me, this is something radically different. It's something we need to think about very seriously. In many ways, there's a lot more at stake from now over the next couple of centuries than has been over the last couple of centuries. So I want to make sure we take that seriously. We really think about what we're doing and we think about the potential of these technologies. And I called it the Plasticine. It's a sort of a play on several words. It's a play on the Pleistocene,
right,
a former epoch. It's a play on plastic. And it's a play on Plastocene, that childhood toy that I grew up with in England, this sort of infinitely malleable dough. It's like a Play-Doh. And in my eyes, the Earth is becoming this malleable dough that we're going to increasingly start shaping.
I want to come back to the atom and the atmosphere. after we have you read a short passage, will you?
Absolutely. In the 1967 movie The Graduate, the dazed-looking hero Benjamin Braddock, played by Dustin Hoffman, is pulled aside by a well-meaning family friend and told that the key to his future can be found in a single word, plastics. As the friend saw it, an awful lot of the stuff Ben would see around him was going to be synthesized in factories using new types of cheap and highly flexible chemical processes. If Ben knew what was good for him in his career, he needed to make himself a part of it. Today, if Ben were getting such advice, he would hear a much grander promise of an even more startling synthetic future. Humans are no longer just surrounding ourselves with new materials. Our species also is gaining the ability to re-engineer a number of key planetary processes. We are learning how to synthesize and stitch together new arrangements of DNA to build original and useful organisms. We are fabricating novel atomic and molecular structures to create entirely new material properties. We are reassembling the species composition of ecosystems while experimenting with bringing extinct animals back from the dead. We're studying how to deploy technologies that will turn back the sun to keep the planet cool. In each of these ways, humanity is learning how to replace some of nature's most historically influential operations with synthetic ones of our own design. Nobody would deny that major planetary transformations have already occurred. Up to this point, however, most of the major global impacts our species have wrought have all been inadvertent. Nobody planned to sully Alaskan coves with mercury or allow industrial chemicals to penetrate the flesh of whales swimming beneath Arctic ice. Neither the atmospheric warming attributable to the burning of fossil fuels nor the mass extinctions from widespread habitat destruction were deliberate. In all of the transformations to date, global change has been far from the minds of perpetrators. From now on, however, things will be different. After we fully awaken to the global nature of the damages we have inflicted, we have no option but to make our decisions about future actions more self-aware. Like the injured animal we find suffering by the side of the road, the broken planet has suddenly become our responsibility. We no longer have the option of turning away and pretending we have not noticed. Good conscience will no longer permit it.
After reading this book, I took it upon myself to watch the 1967 film The Graduate. And a few scenes after the plastic scene, Benjamin is confronted by Mr. Robinson, and he mumbles, "I'm just a little worried about my future. I'm a little upset about my future." And I sat there going, "Yeah, me too." And what you write is, "The thing that should scare us most about the synthetic age is the prospect of these types of massive decisions, literally world-shaping decisions, not being made democratically." So what's your advice to the commoner who may not know anything like I did about the technology that is happening without us knowing?
So one can't just have a knee-jerk reaction and be anti-technology. If you're concerned about the natural world, you have to be aware of what technology can do to help protect it. And so the path is a complicated middle path. Looking at the technologies that are desirable, being suspicious of the ones that aren't. And in order to shape those technologies in ways that fit with our ethical ideals, as many people as possible need to be involved in these discussions. These are not things that we want to let happen to us, where we're just this sort of passive observer sitting back and seeing new products show up in the stores, which we may or may not choose to buy. The kinds of things that are happening are changing our home planet. And so we all need to be a part of it. We need to be as aware as possible. We need to know who are pushing these kinds of developments, why they're pushing them, what role we can play. Nothing can be better than a higher state of awareness of what's going on.
During the first part of the book, I found myself squinting and getting really close to the pages because it was all about atoms and DNA sequencing. And during the latter part, I was like telescopically holding the book away from me, trying to understand, you know, atmosphere and space. And I got to thinking, does scale imply something about who's in charge of what happens next, whether it's, you know, in the minuscule or the telescopic?
I think scale is relevant to this discussion in part because it is the grand scale of these issues that has now brought them to people's attention, and particularly through climate change. There's something about the global nature of climate change that is stunning to all of us. The idea that something that I do or we do in a certain part of the world can affect everybody else and that nobody can help this happening is really a stunning realization of our time. So I think looking at things from the level of the atmosphere immediately clues you into how globally significant these changes are. But you can take that same story all the way down through species, through individual organisms, down into DNA, and down into atoms and molecules. It's the same story that you find down at that level. And so if climate change is the scale at which we become alert and perhaps a little scared about this, we should take the same feelings down to those other scales and recognize that the same kind of re-engineering is taking place at the atomic and molecular levels as could take place at the atmospheric level.
Can change happen at the human scale? Can it happen in sort of the normal world and outside of laboratories?
Well, we have a tendency to see our problems as best fixed through technology. It's a nice idea. Someone will come along with a technology and they'll make it so that I don't have to worry about what I'm doing. Mm. Occasionally, that's true. Occasionally, a technology can solve a difficult problem. Anti-lock brakes stopped a lot of people sliding off the side of the road in wet and icy conditions. So that's great. But our problems are not just problems that are amenable to technological fixes. Some of them require social and behavioral and economic fixes. And those sorts of fixes require engagement from people. Technological fixes don't really require engagement. You sit and you wait and someone comes along and hands you a new iPhone or someone hands you a great solar panel or something like that. You don't have to do anything. But those behavioral and social fixes, the ethical fixes where we change our behavior as individuals, those require engagement. They require knowledge, they require conversation, awareness, commitment. And so part of what I hope to do in the book is lay out some of the technology, but also lay out some of the deeper ethical issues that individuals might be able to engage with themselves.
Your book includes a number of voices, including, you know, wealthy scientists to deep-thinking philosophers and authors. I kept looking and listening for the women's voices and the indigenous voices and the voice of humility. Do those voices matter? And if so, where do we find them?
So those voices are absolutely critical. And this is one of the concerns when you put all your eggs in a technology basket. If you put your eggs in that basket, you find yourself in places like MIT or in Silicon Valley, and you find yourself talking to people who have the resources to push those technologies, and in some cases, push them to market because there's a lot of money to be made with those technologies. But when we're talking about things that are going to affect the whole Earth, you have to also talk to the people who are going to be affected. And part of what got me into some of this work is we had a project here at the University of Montana and a PhD student who traveled to the Arctic, he traveled to sub-Saharan Africa, to the Pacific Islands, and talked to people most affected by climate change and asked them how they would proceed with climate engineering. So you can go to MIT and talk to people there about how they would proceed with climate engineering, and you get a very different kind of approach than what you get if you go and talk to people in the Arctic. And so engaging with the communities that are affected, engaging with the communities that have suffered a long history of colonialism and exploitation, and worrying about the fact that some of these technologies are going to continue that sort of history, I think that's critically important. It's a technology-focused book, and in this case, many of the people I spoke to were the people researching and working on those technologies. But in no way at all does that mean those are the only people you need to speak to.
Right. Can you describe or define maybe the collaboration or friction then between the commercial interest and the public interest in these new technologies?
So it varies from technology to technology. So climate engineering, which is this global attempt to bring temperatures down, there's broadly been a consensus that if you're doing that by interrupting the sun's rays, and the technical term here is solar radiation management, there's a broad consensus that if you do that, you should only do it as a public good. So that means you don't do it out of commercial interest. You don't do it to make money. You do it because there's been a consensus that there's things you can affect here that will make things better for the whole planet. So in that case, there's been a consensus that you don't let commerce dictate what is happening. In other cases, that consensus hasn't arrived. So for example, in the construction of synthetic organisms, I heard one of the leading researchers in this area stand up at the beginning of his talk and say the world's first trillionaire will be the person who can develop and market a globally useful synthetic organism. So in that case, you've got commerce pushing it. To me, that's a lot more worrying. I mean, it's hard enough to talk about a global public good and how to manage that. I mean, think about the UNFCCC and climate change. It's challenging. But at least you require consensus. You require a broad and deep conversation about it. Take it out of the public realm, put it into private hands, commercial hands, and you have to worry that some of this stuff is going to arrive before we've even thought it through. You have to worry that this stuff is going to appear and be changing nature in these fundamental ways without any discussion, but just as a consequence of the commercial potential.
Can you give both an example of solar radiation management and a synthetic organism?
So the most broadly discussed solar radiation management technique is the idea of depositing particles or droplets in the stratosphere, probably from a hose connected to a balloon. So this balloon would rise up into the stratosphere 50, 60,000 feet. It would be carrying a hose, and you would pump out of that hose droplets into the stratosphere, and those droplets would have reflective properties to them. And those reflective properties would keep some of the sunlight from entering into the atmosphere. It would bounce it straight back out into space. And if you calibrated it right, you could keep just enough of the sun's rays out of the atmosphere to keep temperatures below the dangerous places we're heading. So that's a good example of a solar radiation management technique. That's the one people are getting most excited about right now. It's going to be tested in the Arizona desert this summer by a group from Harvard. Moving down to the molecular level, synthetic organisms, we're just at the start point of that technology. What has happened so far is a minimal genome has been constructed. And what does that mean? Yeah. A minimal genome is the smallest amount of genetic material that can keep a bacterial cell alive. So there's bacteria all over the planet with all kinds of different lengths of genomes. And researchers found one of the smallest of these bacteria. They figured out how to build it in a lab. So that was step one, mimicking or copying or recreating a very small bacterial genome in a lab. Then when they'd figured out how to recreate it, they started knocking out genes and finding which ones were essential for life. As you know, evolution doesn't always work in the most efficient ways, so every genome has inessential genetic material in it. So they knocked out genes to find out which ones were inessential, and they were able to shrink this genome down. When they had knocked out every last gene that was inessential, they realized they had the minimal amount of genes that was necessary for life. They synthesized that in a lab, took that synthesized genome, put it in a bacterium, and that synthesized genome took over the operation of the bacterium, and it started dividing. So you've got a synthetic genome running a bacterium. Now, at this stage, no one's developed a useful synthetic bacterium. This is all just proof of concept stuff. Can you build it in a lab? Can you make it run a bacterium? The answer is yes, you can. So now that's accomplished. What people are trying to figure out is, all right, what can I add to that minimal genome to start it doing useful things for me? And those useful things could be anything from grabbing carbon out of the atmosphere, decontaminating polluted sites, helping break down biomass to create biofuels. There's all kinds of things you could use a useful bacterium for. But we're not there yet. At this stage, we've synthesized a minimal genome in a bacterium. And we've shown that that bacterium can run, it can work, it can stay alive. So this is just the beginning. And this is why we got to think about this now. This is the opening salvo in what could be a very different biological world.
I hear you walking this fine line really diplomatically and, you know, with this scientific mind, and yet you're a philosopher. And so I want to talk about God, because God appears in this book. If I'm thinking like an atheist, you know, if God is a social construct, then how can we say that we're writing the language of God when we're participating in these type of technologies?
So I'd been working in several of these areas for a number of years, and people who were unhappy with these technologies almost always would say, you're playing God. This is humans playing God. Mm-hmm. They're trying to adopt a role that they shouldn't be adopting. Now, I'm not a theist myself, and so the playing God language doesn't fit for me exactly. But that language overlaps with a related sense that there is something morally powerful, something significant about this world that has been handed down through hundreds of millions of years of processes that humans did not control. These were processes that were taking place way before us. And we arrive and we're here and we're surrounded by this world. And then when someone sets out to re-engineer it, they are disrupting or interfering with something that has deep moral resonance. Now, you can call that playing God if that fits your worldview. Or you can just call it messing with nature if that better fits your worldview. But in either case, it's humans stepping into a role which is not a familiar role. It's a dramatic role. And it's a role that I think has very serious consequences.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Christopher James Preston about his nonfiction book, The Synthetic Age: Outdesigning Evolution, Resurrecting Species, and Reengineering Our World. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. In the second half, Christopher makes the case for wildness in the coming times. I've been reading a lot about place, and one of the terms I've come across is reciprocal guardianship. You know, that landscape and place takes care of us, and our moral obligation would be then to take care of it. And so I'm curious, you know, how would you frame reciprocal guardianship in the world of the synthetic age?
It's clear that in the synthetic age, we are going to have to put some effort into restoring the mess that we've made. So what I was calling the Anthropocene earlier on, this giant accident, this unfortunate scene of destruction, it's clear that we have to do something to repair that. And there's technologies that are going to help us do that. But then I can imagine a line being crossed where you go from repair to redesign. And crossing that line should not be done lightly. One of the quotes I have in the book is from a chemist called George Whitesides, who says, it would be a marvelous challenge to see if we could outdesign evolution. I can see why that's technologically interesting. I can't see why that's necessarily prudent. Evolution provided the source material for everything that humans value, for the whole context in which we exist. And the idea that it might be a good idea to out-design it or redesign it, I think one has to ask questions about that. So while being optimistic about how technology can repair things for us, I'm less optimistic and, let's just say, cautious about the idea of technology redesigning these fundamental processes.
You talk about this notion of responsibility. We can no longer avoid being responsible. And yet, in taking greater responsibility, we might face increased what you call existential anxiety. If we're now in charge of the atmosphere, how do we not walk around going, blame ourselves for the weather day to day? I don't know. What would you say about that?
I do think this question about existential despair and responsibility, it comes up very acutely with climate engineering. It's great to walk out of your door in the morning, look up, see snow falling, and say, hey, snow in May.
Yeah.
This is Montana. Isn't it great? That's part of what it is to be in a world that we didn't design. We take it as it gets thrown at us. We roll with the punches. We love it. We hate it. We find it difficult. Sometimes we find it fantastically easy. But imagine walking out of your front door when you know that the climate is engineered. So you walk out the front door and it's snowing and you say, oh, the technicians turned the temperature down a bit, didn't they, this week? What if they've turned it down too much? Maybe you should give them a call. Everything would be different. You wouldn't be able to look out at the world in the same way. And what concerns me is this is a dramatic shift in relationship, a dramatic shift in meaning, a dramatic shift in identity. Mm-hmm. It really turns humanity and it turns humanity's relationship with the world into something it's never been before. And before we take that step, we should talk about it and ask ourselves if that's a step we want to take.
How do you imagine these conversations taking place?
I have been asked that question before because what I set out is an ideal. It's a vision, a goal that we can sit down and converse with each other respectfully, thoughtfully, inclusively about these topics. And so I use the word ideal deliberately. It's a guiding ideal. We want to shoot for that as best as we can. Now, with a global technology, can you sit 7.5 billion people down at the same table to have a conversation? Clearly not. But you can make conversations as representative as possible. You can make them as inclusive as possible. You can make these conversations accessible so that people aren't intimidated out of them. That's one of the problems with working in science and technology. It's actually a problem of working in philosophy.
Yeah.
Is people find these conversations overwhelming and intimidating. So my goal is to make these topics accessible, available, make them welcoming, and moving forward, hoping that those who are deciding how to promote or regulate these technologies do so with as much inclusiveness as they possibly can. And we should push them every step of the way.
I'm thinking about those of us in the West. We're quite attached to an identity of wildness. And I mean, I was heartbroken when I read, you know, we're living maybe in a post-wild or post-nature world. Can you explain that and soothe me?
I'm not sure I can be soothing on this topic, but I'll do my best to talk about it, explain it a little bit. So the idea of a post-natural world is a world in which nature is now tainted by the human touch. And you can choose chemicals, you can choose greenhouse gases, you can choose invasive species, you can choose any one of those vectors that the Anthropocene theorists say have now indicated that we've left the Holocene behind. So once we live in a post-natural world, I guess we also live in a post-wild world, because there is nothing out there in the natural world that is operating completely independently of us. So wildness, if you look back into the etymology of the word and the history of the word, it means things like self-willed or autonomous, self-driven, something like that. So if humans are now involved in everything, there's nothing completely self-willed or self-driven or autonomous. We've already put shackles on things by changing the climate in which it lives or by changing the chemistry of where it lives. So there has been this tendency to talk about humanity as now being in a post-natural and post-Wild epoch. I disagree with that. Wildness inhabits everything that we build. Even when we've had an impact over the whole planet, wildness still lurks in the cracks and in the crevices of this planet. Wildness is inherent to biology, for example. Wildness is inherent to culture and society. There will always be wild forces at work in whatever kind of synthetic age we try to create. Now, I try to keep that as a theme that is lurking in the background of this book.
Yes.
Because I don't think we should become too confident about our ability to engineer this complex, rich, diverse world in which we live. We can certainly attempt to manage it, but we should always be cognizant of wildness. And this is wildness in animals that we might move around the planet, animals that we might de-extinct.
Right.
It's wildness in the machines that we will build that won't completely do exactly what we built them to do. It's wildness in the cultures that will live in this synthetic age, where strange political movements will arise, charismatic individuals will lead people off in certain directions. Wildness will inhabit the synthetic age. Is that good news? Well, it's good if you like wildness. It's also bad news because it hangs a cloud over this attempt to re-engineer the world. We will never be completely successful at doing that. And that's something that should perhaps be a cause for worry and a little bit more humility than we sometimes show.
I was just reading an Orion Magazine article by Robin Wall Kimmerer about language and empathy and animacy, the notion being that we might describe or address animals, plants, and landscapes by using pronouns. How does language fit in with the synthetic age? And how does it impact our relationship with the world?
One of the suggestions that has been made about the prospect of a synthetic world is that we're essentially turning life into machine. Things that were living, part of the natural world, part of an evolutionary inheritance, they suddenly flip over and they become machines, living machines. When you do that, what you do is you erode a boundary between one important concept and another important concept. A concept that was previously associated with magic and mystery and animacy suddenly becomes associated with physics and chemistry and mechanical principles of operation. And when you do that, you lose something. The language changes, and as the language changes, the sense of responsibility changes. Any sense of respect or even awe changes and risks going away. And so that certainly is a threat in the synthetic age. If you can talk about everything as something that can be rebuilt or re-engineered, you risk evacuating significance from concepts that really are orienting concepts. Life, species, the living world. If all of those terms move over and become part of the engineering lexicon, you worry that we lose something significant.
Darkness comes to mind. Will you read us a bit about the banishment of darkness?
Absolutely. A second and related agent of evolutionary change is the progressive banishment of darkness from the world at the hands of electric light. Paul Bogard has written poignantly of his deep regret at the end of night. He points out that the spread of electricity across many parts of the globe has condemned real darkness to the planet's history. This lack of night comes with sizable biological consequences. Excessive illumination is disrupting the natural rhythms created by millions of years of the Earth's steady axial rotation. The first photos of the Earth from space taken by lunar-bound astronauts revealed a spectacular blue marble poised in front of a star-speckled expanse. The individuals lucky enough to see the planet from this vantage point were all transformed. Edgar Mitchell memorably described his impression of it as a small pearl in a thick sea of black mystery. The planet's finitude, its swirling beauty, and its apparent fragility gave our species its first clear sense of our lack of astral significance. Norman Cousins later remarked that what was most significant about the lunar voyage was not that man set foot on the moon, but that they set eye on the Earth.
After I got through the part in your book about living in a post-wild place, I got to thinking about awe and wonder, and I was surprised that we can experience awe and wonder with technology. In this instance, through, you know, photographs from space. And so I want you to make your best pitch to me about how we can retain awe and wonder as we move into the synthetic age.
There's no problem with being awestruck by the power of our technologies. Many of them are remarkable. Many of them do wonderful things for us. And so we should certainly not be frightened of admiring the technologies and those who build them. The danger, I think, is when we lose sight of the world that those technologies are built out of and the world that those technologies are designed to look at, because that's the world that is the source of everything that we build. And when we lose sight of life and replace it with machine, when we forget about climate because we think we can just re-engineer it to be more conducive to our interests, we lose something that is elemental to us. We lose something fundamental. It's still there, and it will remain there. But our language can take us away from it. Our focus can take us away from it. We can get too wrapped up in the things we can do, and we can lose sight of what the world does for us. And so my call in the synthetic age is not to reject the technologies that can do immense good for people. It can lift people out of poverty. It can increase health. It can increase access to energy. So my call is not to reject those technologies, but to remember the world that lies behind those technologies, to keep appreciating its richness, and to keep appreciating its independence from us, and to try to cultivate, help that independence to flourish where we can.
This is my last question. How do you like to have fun, and is it ethical to have fun?
I guess I would say a lot of the fun I have is had in relation to the world that is independent of me. So I love my vegetable garden, but I cannot control those carrots. Sometimes they germinate, sometimes they don't. Sometimes the potatoes are massive, sometimes they are pathetic. So that's a world I can't control. I love to bike around Missoula, do a lot of mountain biking. And I just love the arrays of flowers that you see over the next month or so from now. I love the fact I can come around a corner and spook a deer. I love the fact I can come around a corner and be spooked by a black bear. So a lot of the fun I have is in relation to this world that I do not control. I don't have much of my fun in relation to a synthetic world. I have a lot of it in relation to a natural world. And is that ethical? Well, I can't see why it wouldn't be. It's exciting. It's interesting. It's something that's great about living here where we do. So I have no problem with having fun in this natural world.
Christopher James Preston originates from Brighton, England. Upon moving to the United States, once he started heading west, he just kept going, eventually ending up as a commercial fisherman in Alaska. He now lives in Missoula, Montana, where he teaches philosophy at the university. Look for more information about his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.